I'm here with Sama Shuri in her living room in Bristol, sitting by her log burner. Thank you, Sama Shuri, for taking part in the project.
You're welcome.
So I wanted to begin by asking you, what started it for you? What was it that set you out on a spiritual life, or what was the grit that brought you to the Dharma?
Well, I think it's all Karuna Matti's fault. No, not her fault, it's her. My blessing, really, that I knew Karuna Matti. So we were both at medical school together in the 1990s, living in Hackney. I was sharing a house with her at one point, but it was before I was actually living with her. I was struggling at medical school and was having a bit of a sort of mini breakdown and quite stressed. And she'd already started coming to the LBC at that point and suggested to me that meditation might be a good thing to practice. So I took on board that and went off to the University of London Student Union, where they had some yogic group offering meditation, because I wanted to, you know, be an individual and not follow her right to the same place. But the group I ended up doing meditation with ended up being some kind of slightly weird cultish group. So I soon decided to give them a miss and found myself at the LBC and haven't looked back since.
So do you remember the first time you went?
No, I can't remember the specific time. I can kind of remember the LBC being very new and it feeling very new and strange. And I think my main sense was how friendly everybody was, just all these lovely people that were very kind and really interested in me and anyone else. Yeah, and how I felt quite at home very quickly. That's what I remember. Seems a long time ago now.
So when would that have been?
The mid-90s, so sometime after. I can't remember the exact year, to be honest, but I started medical school in 93. So it must have been around about 95, 96, I think. So I ended up becoming a mitra at the LBC, going on my first retreat there. That was a very memorable experience, the Women's Easter retreat at Water Hall with the mice.
With the mice.
With the mice, yeah.
So what happened on that retreat?
I just remember it being really magical. Bara Badri and...
Oh, Muditoshri.
Yeah, Muditoshri, yes. Yeah. So they were leading it. And there were a lot of the people on the team are now in the order as well. And quite a few people that I knew from the beginners class were on the retreat as well. Karuna Matti was on the retreat. My friend Tina was on the retreat. Loads of people, and it was just really magical. It was Vara Badri's magic, I remember, particularly. The rituals were just stunning, and I really I always find Easter a magical time anyway, so I think my mind was blown away on that retreat, really, just taken into this magical realm where everyone was joining in with my feeling, sense of magic at least. And I remember feeling quite shy and talking to I can't remember anyone's name tonight, but another Dharmacharini now. She was on the team, and I really wanted to make friends with people, and I really liked Tina, but I was too shy. And this other older member said, oh, why didn't you tell her, you know, talk to her? And I left her a little note under her pillow. It was so sweet.
Oh.
And we've been friends ever since. So it's
nice. Really?
Yeah.
So what was it about Vara Badri? It sounds like Vara Badri had quite an effect on you.
Well, just her uniqueness and how much she's in touch with the magical realm and the myth, and she's so much an individual and into nature spirits and things. I really connected with that. So growing up in Devon, I'm very much into that side of things, and that took me into Buddhafield as well. So I remember talking to Vara Badri about wanting to become a mitra on top of a hill near Glastonbury on a Buddhafield retreat I was on with her. And Vara Badri ended up leading. We had a naming ceremony for our two girls a couple of years ago, and she led that for us. So I've had an ongoing connection with Vara Badri.
And an ongoing connection with Buddhafield.
Yes.
So when did you first go to Buddhafield?
Again, while I was a medical student in London with Karuna Matti. We went we went to Glastonbury Festival as medical students. Well, we were just having fun students. Having quite a wild time, but she knew about Buddhafield at that point, so she dragged me up to the healing fields to go and find the Buddhafield Cafe and meditation space. So we went there, and again, Bimla Chitta was leading an introductory meditation session in one of the tents there. That actually might have been the first... Maybe I did that before I went to the RBC. That might have been my first experience of meditation.
Mm.
Yeah, it could well have been. And then I just ended up volunteering at the Buddhafield Cafe at Future Glastonbury's, and that's how I met Ratnarashi, chopping carrots with him. Yeah, and I just enjoyed practicing with Buddhafield because, the simplicity of being outdoors again with nature, and we've been very involved with the family retreats ever since, when I was first pregnant with Leela.
What happens on the family retreats?
Well, they're crazy. they're crazy and very simple as well. It's a real experience of community life and dharmic satsanga, living together in a very simple way. And it just feels really nourishing for me because my whole family's there, in a sense. My partner, Ratnarashi, and my two girls and me. And we all get involved and we all love it. And we're all surrounded by the sangha and we're all practicing and exposed to the rituals that have opened to the children as well. I get to meditate because I get time off because the kids are busy, and I get often the same families go each year, so we get that sense of connection. I've been going every year since I was pregnant with Leela, or the year before I was pregnant with Leela, so probably about 12 years now. Mm. Yeah, that feels a very, it's like a linchpin or whatever the word is, like in my year. It's
such a
really important part of my year. Having had children, I don't get away to go on retreat on my own very much at the moment. That's my choice, the way I've chose to parent. So, that's another reason it's really valuable to get away on retreat and take them with me.
Yeah.
I think it helps integrate practice into the family life, because it's like I'm practicing with my kids, so when I come back, there's not such a transition. It's like we just carry on practicing together, but back home again, it feels easier way of doing it. Yeah. It's like I learned practice with the children around. We do meditations with the children around us. We don't separate them out of the room when we're meditating. And
On retreat?
Yeah, on the family retreat. Not all of them, but there are, particularly for parents who've got young children on retreat with them, there's opportunities to meditate with your children around you so that you don't feel like you have to separate your family life from your practice. It's just a way of learning to integrate the two. And
how have you found that, meditating with the children there?
Great. It's very different from how I used to meditate before I had children. It's like with the children you can only do short, sharp meditations like regularly. It's like little and often rather than long sits on a cushion. So I'm usually not on a cushion. I'm usually just sat somewhere or even pushing a buggy, or Beth and Michelle and I do it when we meet. But there's something about it helps bring me presence because of the noise and constantly, you're meditating with half an eye open, just making sure the toddlers aren't killing each other or doing something strange. So it's sort of, I find it a good way to practice just being meditation and all of them really, just because... Well, you've got all your metta for your children arising anyway, and the mindfulness, I just watch my mind all the time being drawn from, being open and then getting caught up in an argument that's happening between the children and then coming back, and it's like just watching my mind going in and out all the time, and because it's so immediate, I can't go off into a daydream, so it's a very good way of meditating to be present and just watching the mind in the present moment, sort of... So then again, it's another way of being able to practice mindfulness all the time, not just on the cushion, because that's the way my life is at the moment.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what would you say the effect of those family retreats has been on the children?
Well, I think it's definitely... I can see that the children have had a glimpse of the Dharma and the mythic realm. Mm. And I think it's... I really like that they're sort of around the Sangha in a... it's a healthy environment for them to be in and to see people practicing ethics and ways of being with each other. So it feels like a really... Because children just are like sponges when they're young. It's so much... They mirror what they see around them. So it's just a really lovely... Feels like a very healthy environment to put them in as often as possible so that they can grow up with ethical behaviour around them. Yeah.
And Leela's had that from when she was tiny. I was suddenly remembering... Beth running a drumming workshop when Leela was so small she was on your lap in the middle of a drumming workshop, asleep.
Yes. Yeah. And Leela's developed some really good friends from being on that retreat every year for her life and loves going back there. And it also gives them a sense of freedom, which children don't have these days often, that the field that we have the retreat in is a fairly safe environment. So the older ones, well, from about 4 or 5, like every year as they get older, you can give them a bit more freedom. So Leela goes off for the day and you hardly ever see her. And she just runs around the field with her friend. She has late nights and never brushes her. You know, it's just like sense of freedom that gives her a bit more autonomy and a bit of experience being away from the overprotective parents we tend to be in cities these days, I think, because there's less hazard around. So that's a real opportunity as well. Yeah, I just feel passionate about exposing our children to these environments as well, not just keeping it for myself. Leela wants to come to them. She can't wait till the retreat. It's not like we're dragging them along because we're a Buddhist family. It's very much something she wants to do. And Rosa enjoys. She's developing friendships with Mary and Juliet, and they love each other. And they quite enjoy pretending to meditate and chant their refuges and precepts when we do. And it's just lovely.
I think you would maybe would say a little bit about that group, because there's three of you, aren't there?
Yeah, so that's really made such a difference to me. Now I'm my second child. So Beth and Michelle are two mitras in our Sangha who both happen to have baby girls around almost exactly the same time that I had my second daughter, Rosa. And we were all on maternity leave to start with, so we got together practically every week and met a bit like a mitra group or a GFR group, and we sort of reported in about our practice as parents, and the children would play together or gurgle at each other. We'd meditate. And it's been so supportive. It's really changed my experience this time around. I did, the first time when I had Leela, I did struggle with my whole experience of how to practice and how to connect with a Sangha. That changed so dramatically, and I struggled with not feeling supported. But this time it's just so helped that we're all together, and we still meet, even though we're all back at work now, and we don't meet up every week, but we meet very regularly. And
And you've started running family events
together. So out of that has grown running quite regular every couple of months, either every month or every couple of months, we have a half a day event at the Buddhist Centre, and some other parents come along, and we basically repeat what we do in our group, but for the wider circle. And it seems to work really well. Yeah, it feels very nourishing again, and just feels normal or something. It just feels how it should be. And maybe that's the Marmaki sort of earthiness in me or something about... And including everything, like just wanting to not wanting to partition my life or something.
So Marmaki is your Yidam, practice that you took when you were ordained.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a bit about her?
So she's the female equivalent of Ratnasambhava. Very yellow, very lots of jewels, and very at ease, and sunshiny. That's how I connect to her. I chose her at my ordination 10 years ago. And even though I haven't been doing the sadhana practice very regularly at all, because I struggled to do sitting meditation being a parent. I think she sort of comes in other ways. It's hard to say. I mean, my name, Samashiri, means equanimous heroine. And there's some sort of connection with the equanimity in Malmaki, because Malmaki is all about abundance. And I can sometimes get lost in that abundance and, like, revel in it, but end up craving more and more. So there's something about equanimity. It's about being open to everything in abundance, but not getting overwhelmed by it or something. So it's still about being grounded and at ease with all that abundance. And yeah, it's hard to put into words. Mm. Don't know if that makes sense.
So, yeah, there's very much a relationship between Malmaki and your name. Remember when you first heard your name?
Yes, yeah, I did like it immediately. I remember being in the bell tent that was the cootie. I think it was a bell tent, it was white anyway, I can't remember, with my tray, with mosquito nets everywhere, I think.
At Akashavana.
Yeah, Akashavana. Yes, I did like it immediately. I remember my trace saying she wanted to give me a name that I could use in my work as a doctor. So she wanted one that was easily, like, pronounceable, not too sort of foreign or difficult to say. And I liked the meaning of it. I didn't struggle with it, like the heroine bit, sort of the mythic side of that, feeling like it's good to be recognised in that or something, the heroic aspect of my life. And yes, the Sama, the equanimity bit, feels like a really strong practice, I think, to being grounded and being open, not closing up and feeling overwhelmed, I think, yeah.
So we've skipped to your ordination and your name. I was just wondering if we could go back and if you can, what you might say about what made you decide to ask for ordination.
Well, it almost felt inevitable or something. It just kind of, it's almost like I was drawn along in a positive way by the tide. Just like I was so loving being involved and being a Mitra, and all my Mitra friends around me were asking for ordination. And it's like, it felt a bit like a positive group effect or something. It's like, I wanted to do it too, and it felt really right. And there wasn't any part of me that was struggling with it at that point. It just felt like the right thing to do. I was really drawn to... Well, I've noticed that in me, I often... The way I go about things is I have emotional response to something, and then it's only later on I catch up with a kind of intellectual side of me, thinking, oh, why did I do that or something? So it's like I get drawn along by inspiration and emotion and synchronicity and intuition and all that kind of thing. And I don't quite understand what I'm doing. It's only later I have to sort of pick it apart. Why am I doing this? I guess you could say it was almost blind decisions, but I don't think it's more than that. It's not just a kind of blind leap. It's a sort of positive allowing myself to follow my intuition or something, even though I don't quite understand it at the time. Not knowing where it will take me until I find out. It's like trusting that there's something higher taking me in the right direction, I think. I think I sort of finally came to the decision to write the letter. I was on retreat at Tara Loka, I think, and either wrote the letter there or came home and wrote it, I think, yeah.
And did you always know that you wanted to have children?
No, I didn't. I very much didn't want to have children to start with, but I think as soon as I hit my late 20s, early 30s, it became a really big thing for me. I knew I definitely did want them. And I'm so glad. Well, I couldn't say anything different, but I'm so loving being a mum. I really love it. There's the joy and the heart connection and the experience. Yeah, it just feels very life-affirming, even though it's hard work. Really hard work, but... Yeah, just the physical, part of my practice is very much being embodied as well, having done craniosacral therapy, and I think that's Malmaki as well, but just the whole physical aspect of being pregnant, giving birth and breastfeeding, and again, just the energetic cuddles I get, it's just so physically amazing being human and having that experience, as well as all the difficult stuff. It's, I wouldn't be without it, really.
And I was wondering how you found... Sometimes it hasn't been straightforward for people in the movement who've wanted to have children. I just wondered if you, what your experience of that had been.
It hasn't been entirely straightforward for me, but I think I'm headstrong enough just to do what I wanted to anyway. It felt so strong in me. I you know, it's... For me, it was whether I was going to have children before ordination or after, really, rather than whether I was going to have them or not. For me, it was more the, yeah, the difficulty after, you know, when I had my first child, and then how not struggling to feel accepted at the local centre and not being able to go on retreat and things like that, and just feeling like I have to make choices about whether I want to be there for my children or practice or something, having to separate it when I didn't want to. Yeah, and for me, I did end up kind of finding more connection with the Steiner movement after Leela was born, because I was struggling with feeling a bit alienated from the Sangha at that point, and I sort of ended up having strong heart connection and feeling welcome in the Steiner Sangha, where so Leela's been through Steiner kindergarten and she's at Steiner school now. Yeah, and non-violent community. So I ended up sort of drifting off, never losing my connection with the Tri Ratno Sangha, but ending up having to supplement it with other strands to for that heart connection, because I was struggling with Tri Ratno, and I still have those other connections. So the other one was the NBC community, so doing a lot of non-violent communication stuff, and there was a there is a woman in Bristol who does non-violent communication workshops specifically for parents, and we've been on retreats, well, yeah, camps they call them, with them, and there's a little community of us that do that. So it has been tricky, but not devastating, I guess. And it's, I guess, yeah, I guess I didn't have the strength or desire to fight my corner when I felt like I wanted things to be different with Tri Ratno, so I've just supplemented in other ways. But not being so disheartened that I've left, I've sort of accepted that that's how it is. And but this time round with Rosa, because we've had our family connections and with Buddhafield, it's, I guess I found my niches within Tri Ratno that have worked better, but there's still some niggling frustrations about
it. I was going to ask you whether you felt things had changed or were changing.
Not very fast. I don't think they're changing. I think there's... it's hard to know what's... Because I don't talk to a lot of people about it. Because I get my life's so full on with work and parenting and practice. I haven't had much energy to kind of face it and talk to, have lots of conversations with people. So I can only go on the sense I get. We have had struggles still. When I say we, I mean me and Beth and Michelle. Often we felt excluded from events at the Buddhist Centre, but there's always been sort of reasons, and it's always felt difficult from our side that those decisions have been made. And I feel like I'm waffling a bit now, but I guess I'm still left with some frustration, but I feel it's changing a little bit. But it feels like hard work still.
So what would you like to be different, I guess, is the question I'd ask.
I guess in a, you know, if I could, well, in a, you know, a vision could be that, for example, the Buddhist Centre, you know, I've got this vision of it throwing its doors open to absolutely everybody, including children, because it feels like it's trying to throw its doors open to everybody except children at the moment. It's like you have to be a consenting adult to make your own choice to go there. So something about, throwing its doors open to everybody, so that their events, the team sort of consider events that are suitable for families, for children, for people that don't want children, you know, so events, so that there are separate events for everything, and that especially festival days are, you know, without any thought whatsoever, inclusive for everybody, with... Yeah, without having to... It still feels like we have to fight our corner a bit. So, oh, can we come with our children, please? And it is a bit of a struggle sometimes. There's a really helpful Facebook group for Tree Ratna parents. I can't remember the title of it, but there's a lot of really positive stuff on there about what other people do at different centres, and we sharing of resources and ideas, and talk about practice and families. So that's a really good thing. So that's a strand. Yeah, I don't know what else to say, really.
I'm just really getting that sense of how passionate you are about practicing as a parent. Mm.
Yeah.
What would you say has most supported you with that?
Gosh, that's a question. I don't think it's one thing. I think it's a combination. So I think it's, for me, I live, my partner's an order member as well, Ratna Rashi, so that really helps, that we both can understand each other and try and support each other and being able to practice. The fact that I had a good few years behind me before I had children, that's really helped. My faith, I guess, that, I don't know, I just keep coming. Oh, it's like it's in me, I practice as a parent. You're asking what's supporting me? I think the group with Beth and Michelle has been very influential over the last 2.5 years.
So a sangha of people practicing the same way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's finding the sangha. Yeah.
One of the questions that Vidyamala's suggested for the project, it's quite a big question, but it just came to mind when you were talking just then. So what does the centrality of going for refuge mean for you?
Well, I had an image of the golden thread going down through my middle, that it's in my blood or something. Going for refuge is what I am and what I do. It doesn't matter whether I'm changing a pooey nappy or talking to patients or at the Buddha Centre meditating or on an order weekend. It's what I do. And that's where practice keeps bringing me back to that and just remembering. As a parent, constantly practicing ethics is such a big thing because your children mirror you back all the time. So you can't get away with being sloppy. So I'm constantly having to practice metta and ethics at the same time, self-metta and ethics, and just oh no, I've done that again, because my child's doing this back at me, and oh no, I shouted at her again, or oh no, I grumbled at Ratna Rashi. It's just like the intensity of family life is excruciating in a way, and that when you're trying to practice as well, and having a regular chapter and regular meets with the Sangha, with Beth and Michelle, and getting to events at the Buddha Centre when I can. It's all things that just keep polishing the golden thread to remind me that's what's going on.
Yeah, it's a beautiful image. You mentioned your work a couple of times, being a GP. I was wondering what made you decide to take up medicine?
I think it's the wounded healer myth, I think, because when I was growing up, I had quite a lot of time, hospital visits for corrective, like plastic surgery and things. Mm. So I had quite a lot of experience of being in hospital and seeing doctors and nurses. And my dad is a GP, well, he's retired now, but he was a GP as well. So I had experience of him and his work and things. I went to a private girls' school, and my parents always encouraged me to work hard, and I ended up doing really well at sciences and things. So I was just in the private girl environment. I was encouraged to do something like professional, like be a doctor or go to law. And again, at age 16 or 18, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, so I thought I'd give it a go. Like I said, with a wounded healer myth, I've definitely, my samsara has been very much around struggling with, I was born with a genetic condition that meant that my skeleton grew slightly asymmetrically, and I've had a lot of plastic surgery and my eyes are weird. So my samsara has been around struggling with self-image and the effects on my mood, I guess that's had, and anxiety around my eyes, which is still very current, and so, why did I get onto that? Yeah, the wounded healer myth. So I guess part of me wanting to be a doctor has probably been around my psyche trying to sort that all out, I guess, sort of helping others like I've been helped or I'm being helped. But again, it's a tough path. I do feel very stretched at the moment, sort of practicing as a parent and being a doctor and trying to keep all the finances going and stuff, because being a doctor can be very challenging emotionally and ethically, and trying to keep up to date with all the new changes and things. But I do, again, I love the connection, the classic being able to help people, being able to just the privilege of having those connections with people and people telling you their stories and their life, letting you in to their, you know, their worst fears and their worries, and people, you know, the joys of people having babies and finding out they're pregnant, and the worries of, have I got cancer? And yeah, it's just a lot.
And you work with a very diverse community, don't you?
Yeah, so I've worked a lot in inner city Bristol. So a lot of refugees and people whose language isn't English, first language isn't English, and a lot of domestic violence stuff and drugs and alcohol. And yeah, so it's quite a gritty population to work with. And yeah, you do see a lot of suffering. And the thing I find hardest now is not being able to, feeling overwhelmed, because we're stuck with a 10-minute appointment and you're trying to do so much in such a small time. It's just that I feel like I do people a disservice and myself. But at the end of the day, I'm worn out. It's just not very sustainable. So I only do it part-time. I also do craniosacral therapy, which is much more nourishing, but doesn't pay so well, unfortunately. So for years I have been trying to find other ways of working, because it is quite painful sort of wanting to help, but feeling a bit overwhelmed by it as well as a GP. I'm slowly diversifying the way I work at the moment.
Is there anything you particularly say about practicing in that context, Amanda?
Well, I guess, again, I'm very much out in the world. You know, I'm not around any other Sangha members when I work. So it's coming back to my own practice, my own going for refuge all the time, and not allowing myself to be dragged down or swayed by all the other stuff that's going on, or, by the worldly ways. But trying to find like-minded souls within all that. So, I've got gradually finding more connections within the medical world of people that are more open to spirituality and other ways of doing things. Yeah.
Something we haven't talked about is Sankarachita. I wondered if you wanted to say anything about your sense of him or your connection or not or whatever with him.
Yeah. I've never met up with him one-to-one, but I have... You know, I've been to book signings and stuff, so I've been in, and I've seen him at order weekends where he's had birthday and stuff like that. So I've been around him in that sense, but not, I don't feel like he doesn't know me, you know, I've never met him in that sense. I think I have a much stronger connection with like senior order members who I've had a more personal connection with. So it's like my trades, my preceptor. And I can see that she's got a very strong connection with him. So it's sort of, it's like through the lineage, I guess. There's a connection like that. And through his reading, there's his books and stuff, his poetry. So I guess I admire him, and I appreciate everything that he's given me and us through his teachings and writings and creating the Sangha and stuff. And I enjoy reading stuff from other teachers as well. So, sort of don't feel like I need to limit myself to him, although he's obviously the centre of our movement. So I guess I'm Generation Order members where he's slightly more removed because you haven't had a personal connection with him.
Yeah, it's a connection through
others.
You have a connection with him. Actually, something we didn't touch on earlier was who was the first Order member that you felt like you really met?
Yeah, well, I guess it's either Vimnachitta or Borobudur that we talked about, Borobudur. But Vimnachitta, so she was around the LBC when I first came along and started going to the introductory classes, and I think she must have been in the introductory class team then, and she led the Mitra study group that I was in. So she felt, she was young and, you know, lovely and friendly, and I just felt at ease with her quite quickly. So I appreciated her and her kindness and just...
I was wondering what your sense of her was.
Yeah, well, her sort of, her friendliness and kindness and her sort of, well, I don't know what the word is. It's like, I think one day I was grumbling, saying, oh, I wish I could train as a yoga teacher instead of being a medical student. And she said, oh, why don't you? It's like her, and that was so refreshing to hear that. You know, it's like, she wasn't one of those sort of serious adults that thought you better think about things first. You know, in a positive way. It's like her in the momentness or something. Yeah, that's what I really liked about her. I don't see her now. She's moved to Stroud, which I haven't seen her for a long time. So, yes, I don't have an ongoing connection with her, but she was very important at the time, first sort of drawing me into the movement and helping me feel at home. And I guess the other person who just came to mind was... your name's not good at the moment, because I'm not around the orders that much at the moment. Is it Shantachitta? The woman who worked at Evolution from up north, from Newcastle, who's now, was it T. Ratnaloka?
Shantavadri?
Shantavadri? Is it Shantavadri? No. I don't know. Bad, my... it's baby brain, I think. Toddler brain. Anyway, she, I remember she took me under her wing a bit. I used to help out at Evolution in Bethnal Green a bit when I was a medical student. I used to sort of do the equivalent of a Saturday job or just go and help out now and again. And again, it was just so lovely being around something different from medical school and just being around the... I guess the magic that the Sangha has, and I just remember her being sort of interested in me and sort of being kind and took me under her wing a bit.
So looking back, so it's over 20 years since you first got involved in the LBC,
yeah.
If you're saying it was the mid-90s.
Yeah.
I wonder, sort of we look over that period, there's a question that's something like, what matters, what would you say is important or what stands out in that sort of landscape, whether it's qualities or events? Or it's deliberately a very open question, which makes it quite hard to answer.
You mean what matters to me
over
that time, or what's been important? I guess I could seems to be distilling down into the three jewels. I guess it's the, like, over all that time, there's the Sangha that's sort of, all those connections and friendships that have held me over the years and been there in support and things. And the Dharma has helped. Yeah, I've really loved, I haven't done much study recently, but I have really enjoyed, all those T. Ratnaloka GFR retreats. Just, I've really enjoyed picking apart the Dharma with my mind and sort of getting to grappling with it. And my training was a big part of all that. Just being able to see through into reality through all that Dharma. And the Buddha, I guess, the Buddha, the sort of the pull, it's the being exposed, finding the Buddha and the transcendental and the mythic realm and allowing, being able to be in the right conditions to be pulled along by that. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Why would it not?
In
what way does it not answer?
I don't know. It feels a bit vague and a bit... It's interesting to think back. I mean, all of it's mattered, all of it's been important, very real, and very, well, yeah, it's like you said, the centrality of my life, that's the thread that's kept going over the last 20 years, and everything else has happened around it. That's what holds me, I suppose. And I don't see that changing.
Something specific was just coming to my mind as you were saying that, which was you were ordained on that first ever Akashavana retreat. I wondered if you wanted to say anything about that experience.
Yeah.
Being up the mountain.
Yeah, well, that was very mythic. They felt very much like a pioneer being, yeah, part of the first group. As you remember, you were there too. And yeah, it was wonderful to be the first group there and first people to be ordained and sort of start off the new tradition for the women's wing. And it's such a dramatic place. Very strong memories of it. And it's such an opportunity to be able to go away for 3 months, and luckily I did that before I had children so that I could do that. And yeah, I'm glad I had that opportunity. Yeah, real opportunity, and I don't know if I'd ever do it again, really. Well, obviously you can't get ordained again very easily.
But you have to leave first.
Yeah.
So maybe one more question?
Okay, yeah.
So we've had a sort of looking back question. There's a sense in which, by recording people for this project, we're sort of hopefully archiving, putting away things for the future. I wonder if there's something you'd say to a future Dharma farer, where it might be a lineage or had the image of a Terma teaching, or it's just something that you'd want to pass on the basis of your experience of these, well, decades now of practicing the Dharma and in these conditions that you've described.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I don't know if this answers it, but what comes to mind again is that it's a very bodily image. It's an image, and it's a bodily image. And I've got this image of the golden thread. So it's like this still point and a middle point and it's sort of the golden thread that goes down into the roots of the earth, so it's very connects you to the earth and it's very grounding. And it goes up through your middle and up to the transcendental. And that even though your life, you know, you might be spinning around that, and all the conditions of life tend to make you spin around that center. If you keep, for me or for anybody, what I feel is the importance bit is having that golden thread and coming back to it and just doing everything to nourish that. And then, well, completely coming out of somewhere, but then you can spin with grace or something. Something like, yeah, that you can be of an effect in the world, you know, however fast you're spinning or slow you're spinning, but if you're doing it from that still point, then you can do it gracefully or effectively. Yeah.
That's beautiful.